Want to imply that the Old Testament was less important than the New, because my department chairman was sitting right next to me, and he's an Old Testament guy. That's why I didn't want to do it. Luke 15, familiar pericope. Parables, sort of, although there's some hermeneutical issue on that. But let's just kind of read through it, beginning at verse 1. We have right away a periphrastic participle, and you were just hoping for that, I know. Eisande auto engidzantes. Yes, you can separate, you know, the form of the linking verb from the participle, and it still is periphrastic. So you throw eison and engidzantes together, just like in English. They were drawing near. That's exactly what this is doing. And then you look for the subject. Oh, there it is. Pontus hoi telonai kai hoi hamartoloi. All the IRS agents and the dregs of the earth were drawing near to him for this. Yeah, right. For this. Bugs, right. Somebody ought to preach on that. For the purpose of hearing him. Here's a good purpose infinitive. I think it's clear enough. This is explains what their purpose was in drawing here. Drawing near in order to hear him. I should speak up or you can't hear me. You know, when you, I have a theory that I'd like to investigate someday, so I'll just throw it out as a theory, and that is when you see the word hamartolos in Luke, it really means hamartolos, sinner, in the sense of society's view. That is, not just we're all sinners, but the people that society rejected as the utterly despicable and unclean. So for instance, when and this is sort of predicated on a couple of features, but for instance, I think that in Luke 5, when Jesus, you know, catches all the fish and Peter falls down and says, "Depart from me, Lord, for I am a sinner," I think he's really saying something there. He's not just saying, "I'm sinful." He's in the presence of the majesty and holiness and power of Jesus. He's really acknowledging something that he might not have ever thought of before. So it's just a theory I have about sinner, especially in Luke's use of the term. Here it's pretty clear they're linked with the tax collectors, who are unclean, mistrusted, and generally not liked by people. And die gungidzon. I like gungidzo because it's sort of onomatopoetic. You know, it means to grumble, right? Gungidzo. So here with diad, I don't think it changes the meaning much. And both the Pharisees and the scribes, imperfect die gungidzon, which this isn't the first time they've gungidzoed in Luke. They've done it in Luke 5, I think. So continued to, maybe. And this isn't the first meal that Jesus has shared with a sinner, right? What? They've been gungidzoing for a long time, so they continued to grumble, saying, sort of like lemor, we just had one of those, sort of a pleonastic or unnecessarily full participle saying, quote, "This person receives prosdekatai kai synesthie and eats with," receives sinners, hamartolos, "and eats with them." And autois is dative as the object of sin estheo because it's got the sin compound on the front, and that changes the case of the direct object compound verb. So here's the setting, which is very important for the interpretation of these two little parabolic units and also the prodigious son, you know, which is coming up here beginning in verse 11. And he said to them this parable, verse 4, saying... Now here's this construction. We had it last time. We get tis ex himon followed by a negative indicative, ou katalepe. You know, literally, which of you does not? Okay. And I wanted to wave this book at you. Did I wave this book last week? Well, I brought it again. It's still a good book. It's and Ken Bailey, Mr. Oriental Exegesis, graduate of here under Martin Charlemagne, and great stuff on the parable of cultural insights, you know, on the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin and so forth. So if you haven't bought this book, God's punishment is still impending, but if you buy it, you'll redeem yourself. So it's Erdmann's. You can redeem yourself from the Reformed. Where are we? Verse 4. So Bailey proposes, can it be that this would ever happen? And the answer expected is no, absolutely not. This is normal experience. What man among you, now we have to make a choice on this participle echon, and I think you could go with attributive position translation, who has 100 sheep, that might be the easiest way to go, and who lost out of them one, ex auton hen, does not leave the hen, let's see, enanekanta enne'a, the 99, in the desert, and go upon or to that which was lost. You know, I always have to look up the forms of apolemy. I just hate that verb. This is actually apalolos, is the second perfect active participle, but it functions apparently as the middle or passive participle of apolemy. So which, not which lost itself or perished, but which was lost, which had been lost, the thing which is lost, until, heos heore auta, until he finds it. And often, not always, but often after heos, you have a subjunctive, and that's what we have here. Heore is the aorist subjunctive of heorisko. And then question, you know, question mark. So which of you would not do this? This is what you do. And of course, we wonder, well, how come he left the sheep by itself? Ken Bailey argues that there's more than one shepherd, so it's not a problem. That's how he gets out of that. This is the way you act if you're somebody that's taking care of sheep. You lose one, it's an important investment. You go find it, right? Verse 5, and take this participle maybe sort of temporally. When he has found it, he puts, he epitithemes, he lays his hands on it and ordains it. No, that's not right. He puts it upon the shoulders of him rejoicingly, chiron, right? Participle kind of expressing manner here maybe. And after he goes into the house, no, I guess the other shepherds are bringing the rest of the sheep in from the desert, right? Because he goes back to the house with this one that was lost. And he singkale, he calls together the friends and the neighbors, saying to them, imperative from singkairo, rejoice together with me. Why? Because I found the sheep of mine, the one having been lost. Here's the punchline. I say to you, if this is true, if this is what you people do, if you can't imagine that a person among you would do anything different, then here's the punchline. Sort of moves from the lesser to the greater, right? I say to you that thus joy in the heaven will be upon one sinner repenting, a than. This is one of the ways that Greek can do comparison. So you back up and you see that a and you go, oh, this is a comparison. So you back up and you say there will be more joy in heaven on the basis of or over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous ones who, hoitinus, do not have the need of repentance, do not have the need which is repentance, maybe. And at this point, you're sort of faced with a question, who are these 99 people that don't need repentance? And you could read it straight, I suppose, and have Jesus say that, well, there's sort of a unique joy, you know, if you've got a whole crowd of Christians, for instance, and then there's a person who's a non-Christian and he becomes a Christian, there's a unique joy in heaven over that one who's just been converted. And that would be reading it straight, okay? Given the context, however, and the diagongidzoing that's been going on with the Pharisees, Jesus is probably being ironic here. You know, over 99 so-called righteous people, you know, who think they don't have the need of repentance. I think I'd go that way just because of the audience, right? Jesus doesn't seem to regard the Pharisees as righteous persons who don't need repentance. And that was sort of an understatement. And sort of an appropriate chuckle would have been good at that point. Oh, that Professor Gibbs, he's such a funny guy. All right, I'm not going to look at you anymore. We're going to get to verse 8. What time is it? We're doing great. Boy, some people are fast anyway. Or, now let's just do the same thing, except let's intensify a little bit, because now we move from a ratio of 1 to 100 to 1 to 10, right? Okay. Or what woman who has, ehuzah, 10 drachmas, if she loses one drachma, will not, hapte, kindle a lamp. And here's a verb that I had to look up. I don't know how many times this occurs in the New Testament. Sarao means to sweep. You knew that already from the RSV, right? It does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until heos hu heore. Here's an example. Heos and heos hu sort of mean the same thing most of the time. There's no real difference in meaning there. They just both can be translated as a, let's say that'd be a subordinating conjunction, I guess, until she finds it. And after she has found it, she calls together the lady friends, tas philas, right? This is not a co-ed gathering here. And neighbors saying, rejoice with me. She says the same thing as the shepherd says. Rejoice with me because I found the drachma which I lost. Thus, I say to you, I'm not parsing many verbs here, but they're all, apolizas, aorist, and, synchairetes, aorist, imperative, and so forth. So, anyway, verse 10, thus I say to you, joy happens before the angels of God over one sinner who is repenting. And again, the stark contrast here is the the attitude of the Pharisees over the sinners who are repenting, right? I mean, by the way Jesus tells the story lets us know. I had somebody ask me one time, well, did Jesus just sort of let people like these scummy, sinful people just come to him and, I mean, not change? Or how does this work? Well, we'd want to say theologically that, of course, that he's invited them to dine in his gracious invitation, law and gospel, work, beginning to work, faith, and so forth. Here, Jesus specifically says it, is that he's, in reference to the people with him, he's there in the parabolic speech. They're the sinners who are repenting, right? And the stark, unbelievably offensive contrast, assuming Jesus is speaking ironically, is that there's joy in heaven over the scum of the earth, but over the bishops and the theological professors, see, no joy in heaven because they're not repenting in the presence of Jesus. So, this could be great law, if you, depending on who you're preaching it to, right? But beautiful, beautiful gospel. Unconditional acceptance. And all that stuff about the setting of what it means to invite someone to a meal in the ancient Near East, And Jesus just isn't stopping at a hot dog stand along the way. It could be that he's even bringing them into a house and acting as the host, because it says he's receiving them, right, and eating with them. So he's not just eating with them. He himself is prosdekomaiing them. So an utterly gracious, in Luke, very often the gospel is seen, almost most clearly in what Jesus does. And all these meals, this meal fellowship in Luke is a powerful theme. Art Just, who teaches at Fort Wayne, his dissertation is on the Emmaus meal and sort of works the whole Gospel of Luke this way. And I think he's right. This is anticipatory of the great eschatological feast, right? And so there's an eschatological twist to the fact that when Jesus comes, when Yahweh comes in the person of Jesus, Yahweh who, Isaiah 25, we'll throw that great feast on the mountains of, is it on the mountains of Israel in Isaiah 25? Yeah? Okay. Already Jesus, in his earthly ministry, begins the feast, right? And he shows his acceptance, his gracious acceptance of sinners by eating with them. So we got 1 minute, and that's a good place to stop. Questions about Greek or meals or anything? John? It's almost portrayed. The question is: are the Pharisees eating along and grumbling with food in their mouths? It's almost as if they're looking on. I don't think they would join the meal if the tax collectors were there. It's a little different than Luke 7, where somebody intrudes into a meal with Pharisees. But yeah, good.